Welcome. My name is Mark Gleason. I'm a professor at Iowa State University, and I'm the director of a three-year project on organic cucurbit production. And this project is funded by the Organic Research and Extension Initiative of USDA NIFA. Interviewing me today for the first episode is Jose Gonzalez. Jose is the coordinator of the project. So, Jose, take it away.
Thanks, Mark. So, let's begin with why are there three states involved in this project?
Yeah, good question. So, we want to know how the systems we're testing behave in different climates, different with different soils, different weather conditions. And so we enlisted the three states, Iowa, where I'm from, and Kentucky, and New York. All three of those states face similar disease and insect problems as typical of the situation in the eastern U.S., but they're far enough apart that what will be suitable for Kentucky and New York may be different in some ways than what we find suitable in Iowa. So I think it's powerful to have three states involved. The other value of that is that we have project or principal investigators that everyone brings their different expertise. So we have a group from Iowa State with a diverse expertise, but then we have different expertise from University of Kentucky and different expertise from Cornell University in New York. And we also have a sociology consultant, Lois Wright Morton, in Ohio, who is handling the sociological parts of the study.
So, Mark, why do cucurbit growers worry about bacterial wilt and cucurbit yellow vine disease?
Bacterial wilt is a problem anywhere from Kentucky north to Canada and from Iowa east to New York and New England. And this disease can actually kill cucurbits, particularly serious on melons, particularly muskmelon, and also on squash. And what happens is the vines can essentially die. So it's a death sentence for the cucurbit plants. It's a tough one to control. So this is something that causes growers a lot of frustration, particularly organic growers, which is the group that we're focusing on in this project. Cucurbit yellow vine disease is newer. We've known about bacterial wilt for 110 years. That's when it was first recognized, that long ago. But cucurbit yellow vine disease is something we didn't recognize until about the late 1980s, early 1990s. It, like bacterial wilt, is also caused by a bacteria, but it's a different bacteria. This one is called Serratia marchesans, where the bacterial wilt bacterium is called Erwinia tracheophila. Cucurbit yellow vine disease doesn't affect the plants exactly the same way. It does affect a broad range of different cucurbit crops. But what happens late in the season is that the vines turn a bright yellow and can collapse. So this can also be a fatal disease, but typically doesn't show up until later in the season. What we know about cucurbit yellow vine disease, and we're still learning about it, what we do know about cucurbit yellow vine disease is that it's spreading. It was first recognized kind of in the southern plains, Oklahoma and that area, and some of the southern states like Georgia. But we've started to see it further north in Kentucky and Iowa and New York and New England. So this is a disease that we didn't used to have, but has begun to spread around. So we're focusing on these, and cucurbit growers worry about them because we're still trying to figure out the most effective way to control them. And that's particularly difficult when you're in organic production because we don't have the same diversity and effectiveness of weapons for organic production that we do for other growers.
Mark, and as bad as these diseases are for cucurbit crops, is there any concern regarding the climate change that might happen in the future that could impact these diseases?
I think both of these bacterial diseases are carried by insect, particular insects. In the case of bacterial wilt, it's two species of cucumber beetles. In the case of cucurbit yellow vine disease, or CYVD, it is squash bug. So for one bacterial disease, it's the cucumber beetles, and for the other bacterial disease, it's the squash bug. And if we're thinking about changes in the range, in other words, the geographical range of these diseases, it's reasonable to predict that the insects or the ability of the insects to carry these bacteria may change, and also the range of the insects may change. That may change the geographical range of the diseases. And as I said, CYVD is a relative newcomer in our disease picture on cucurbit crops. And so we're still trying to figure out where it's going and how fast. But I think the climate change part of things may drive this changes in the risk through its effect on the insect vectors.
Okay, and why do you think that organic vegetable growers have a hard time controlling bacterial wilt and CYVD?
Well, think about this. The story, a lot of the story is the carrying of these bacteria by the insects, by the cucumber beetles and by the squash bug. So if you're going to defeat these diseases, you've got to stop those insects. If you're an organic grower, you don't have a lot of chemical weapons. You have a few, but the fact is they're not particularly effective. So if you're going to try to go at this with chemical warfare and beat these insects down with organic insecticides, you're not going to be very successful, particularly in years and places where the numbers of those insects are high. They will simply overwhelm the crop and you'll have a high incidence of both diseases.
And under this scenario, how have organic growers tried to control these diseases in the past?
Organic growers tend to be pioneers in alternative ways to manage diseases, partly because, as I said, many chemical options are not open to them. And so they've been imaginative. And there's a number of ways that this has been tried. There's a variety of what you might call barrier systems or barrier structures. The idea is to create a physical barrier between the plants and the insects. So the insects are flying around, maybe from outside the field, and then they come into the field. How can we stop them from landing on the plants and feeding on the plants and thereby transmitting the bacteria? A barrier, oftentimes it's a synthetic fabric of some kind, prevents the insects from having access to the plants. And a number of variations on this theme have been tried. One of them, for instance, is called low tunnels. And as the name implies, there may be 18 inches high, supported on wire hoops, and the plants grow up underneath those low tunnels. And that's worked pretty well, but it's pretty much an early season strategy. Basically from the time of transplanting until the plants start to bloom. At that point, the plants are too crowded in the low tunnels and the tunnels have to be removed. And the other thing that they're removed for is to allow pollination to occur. So low tunnels are okay for part of the season, but what about the rest of the season from bloom until harvest? This is where the bacterial wilt and the CYVD can attack because now the plants are not protected anymore. So low tunnels was sort of partial answer there. You might say, what about high tunnels? Because a lot of growers are using high tunnels, but it's been hard to grow cucurbits economically in the United States in high tunnels because of the investment in the high tunnel. So what about kind of a middle range? And that's what has led us to the idea of mesotunnels. And mesotunnels is a name that we coined to describe a tunnel that's partway between a low tunnel and a high tunnel. High tunnels are maybe 16, 18 feet high. Low tunnels are 18 inches tall. The mesotunnel is in between. It's maybe 3.5 feet tall. And one of the interesting things about mesotunnel systems, and these systems actually were developed by organic growers in the eastern US to try to deal with some of these bacterial problems that we're talking about, the mesotunnels are covered by a different kind of fabric than low tunnels. Low tunnels are typically a spun bond polypropylene fabric like Agribon or Reme. The mesotunnels have a different sort of thing. It's almost like it's a nylon mesh. So it's almost like the screen on your windows. Most window screens now are nylon mesh, and this is not very different. It's typically white in color, but those meshes are small enough that cucumber beetles and squash bugs can't get in. But a real advantage of the mesotunnels is that the plants don't overheat. You know, on a hot sunny day, the plants don't overheat inside that nylon mesh fabric. And also the mesotunnel structure is big enough that the plants don't completely outgrow that space over the growing season. So when you boil that down, you end up with a system that potentially could be used the entire growing season. That's a big advance compared to low tunnels, which will only protect the plants until bloom.
That's great. Now, why do you think mesotunnels could help organic growers fight diseases?
Good question. Mesotunnels have some of the advantages of any barrier system in that they prevent the insects from getting in. As long as they're established, they prevent the cucumber beetles and the squash bugs from getting access to the plants. That's important. But it's really a key advantage of mesotunnels that they may be able to be used almost all season, even right up until harvest. So I'm talking transplant until harvest. That protection can stay in place. We're not worried about overheating of the plants. We're not so worried about crowding so much. But we do have some issues that we need to solve. One of those is weed control in the alleys between the rows. And the other is pollination, because this cucurbit crops, as you know, are completely pollinated by insects. And it takes about 8 visits to an open flower to get a marketable size fruit. So insect pollination is absolutely critical, and mesotunnel systems have to take account of that.
Mark, you mentioned that pollination and weed control are such an issue when using mesotunnels. I wonder, why is that?
That's a really good question. Okay, so let's think about pollination first. You've got to, you know, if you have a mesotunnel set up to exclude insects, well, the pollinators are insects too, and they will be excluded by that same net that's excluding the cucumber beetles and the squash bugs. So somehow we have to figure out a way to get pollination done and still keep the risk of vectoring of those bacterial diseases to a minimum. And this is a real centerpiece of the field research that we're doing. We're looking at a variety of options here. One of them is to open the tunnels completely for 2 weeks during bloom. So the transplants grow up, they're protected by the mesotunnels. And then as the first female flowers start to appear, and we are working with muskmelon and acorn squash, those two cucurbit crops. But as those first female flowers appear, maybe 3 or 4 weeks after transplant, We pull off the covers temporarily for 2 weeks. That allows pollinators from your farm or nearby to find and pollinate, visit and pollinate those flowers. Then 2 weeks after we uncovered the mesotunnels, we recover them. And the assumption we're making there is that 2 weeks was enough for the bees to do their work and provide a good fruit set for a good marketable yield. That's one strategy. So that you put on the mesotunnels at transplant, you take them off at the start of bloom, you put them back 2 weeks later, and then they stay in place until you begin harvest. So 90%, let's say, of the growing season, those mesotunnels are in place. That's far better than you would do with low tunnels, for instance, which only protect for maybe 30% of the season. Here you've got 90% of the season protected. During that time when the plants are exposed, the bees on your farm can do a very efficient job of pollination. And this is a situation where you don't have to invest any money in adding pollinators. The native bees and the honey bees and the others will take care of pollination for you. We've been working with this type of, we call on, off, on strategy. So the nets are on, then they're off, then they're on again for the last year or two. And it has given us pretty good results. We're pretty encouraged by that. Another strategy we're using doesn't open up the tunnels as much. And we call this the open end strategy. So the tunnels are long. We've supported those, that nylon mesh fabric on hoops that are about 3.5 feet high. We run those tunnels as triple rows, so they're large widths of fabric. And when the bloom period starts in this open end strategy, we just pull up the fabric on the ends. This is certainly less work, quicker to do. We just pull up and we clip those ends open and we leave them open for 2 weeks, the same amount of time we were doing for the on-off-on strategy. The idea is that the bees will have access. They can fly in those open ends and pollinate the cucurbit flowers, but it's a limited access. So we're hoping that the bees will be able to fly more efficiently through those tunnels than the cucumber beetles or the squash bugs. And that strategy is another one that we've been evaluating in field trials. Another strategy, which is probably the most elaborate strategy, is to just leave those mesotunnel covers in place all season. From the time we transplant until the time we begin harvest, those plants are covered, period. So how do we do pollination in that situation? We actually buy a box of bumblebees and put it inside the mesotunnel so that the bees can fly up and down and do the pollination. And we only have those mesotunnels open for a matter of seconds while we insert those bees. That's another strategy we're trying. It's not cheap to buy bees in a box. They can be sent to you like anything in the mail. But that's another strategy we're evaluating. You're listening to the Current Cucurbit podcast series. Our 3-year project is searching for more profitable and less pesticide-dependent ways to grow organic cucurbit crops. Now, back to our interview.
Now, how do you think that biological control could fit in with mesotunnels?
Okay, so what is biological control anyway? Biological control means we're using one, typically a microorganism, to control another one. And in this case, our targets are the bacteria that cause the diseases. So Erwinia tracheophila, the causal agent of bacterial wilt, and Serratia marchesans, the causal agent of CYVD. We are looking, and we have some head start here, we're looking for bacteria, good bacteria, you might say, or benign bacteria that can oppose or antagonize the plant pathogenic bacteria that I mentioned. And these have been, these bacteria have been identified in laboratory screening trials, also in growth chamber trials with small plants. Those trials showed that certain bacteria can slow down or even largely stop the progress, particularly for Erwinia tracheophila, for bacterial wilt. But there's another big jump to make, and that is the jump from controlled controlled condition trials like you find in a growth chamber to the field. The field is, of course, where the reality is. And any good bacteria that we develop will need to prove itself in the field. And there's a number of questions to be worked out there, including how should we introduce the bacteria in the field. And those are things that we're going to face as the project goes along. Right now, we're in an earlier stage, just identifying the good bacteria and which ones work most effectively against those disease-causing bacteria. Now, how does this fit in with mesotunnels? Now, the fact is it may fit in or it may not fit in. With organic pest management and disease management, we typically need a range of strategies, not just one strategy, but many little hammers, as they say, in sustainable agriculture. We may need several different strategies. And one possibility is to combine or pyramid a mesotunnel barrier strategy with a biological control that suppresses any bacteria that do get through. So it's logical that they could be combined. We can spray or somehow introduce those biocontrol bacteria right through the mesotunnel fabric because it's that porous. You can spray right through it. So it's certainly possible to combine these two strategies. But by the time we're done with the project in a couple of more years, we may have information that makes either the mesotunnel look more favorable or the biological control look more favorable. But we will be combining those two strategies as well to see whether we, you know, the sum of the two strategies is greater than just adding them together. Maybe kind of a synergistic effect. That's what we're hoping for. And that all fits within the umbrella of organic agriculture.
Okay. Now, I will say that most growers will be asking themselves, can mesotunnels make money for organic growers?
Yep, good question. And it's kind of the question, isn't it?
Yeah.
Of course, we have to control diseases and pests, these key, you know, really important damaging diseases and the pests that carry them. But at what price can we make money on this? And that's why we're looking at a range of strategies. We're looking at three different years in three different states with two different kinds of cucurbit crops, muskmelon and acorn squash. So we're looking at a range of different scenarios, and we have an economic analysis team based at Iowa State. Dr. Wendong Zhang is leading that group. And so we're going to be very focused on this idea of under what circumstances can these strategies make money for growers and under what strategies do they not make sense. So economics is really woven or baked into this project. So we're conferring all the time with the economists, and they are very much partners in what we're doing. So when we have outputs from the project, that kind of question about what the profitability potential is will be addressed directly.
Good. Now, we have talked about our research project field trials, and another aspect of the project is the organic growers. How are they involved in the project?
Yeah, organic growers in all three states are closely involved. Just to give you an idea, we do have an advisory panel that's part of the project, and that advisory panel includes organic growers, three organic growers from each of the three states. So there's nine growers that sit on that panel. And the panel's job, and they get a small stipend for it, but their panel's job is to help us think realistically about what options make sense for growers in the real world. We meet, even despite the pandemic, we meet quarterly, every 3 months, by Zoom. And we keep the growers up on our progress and our ideas, but they provide feedback to us as to what ideas they've tried. And sometimes they're projects or trials with us, and sometimes they're their own trials on their own farms. They feed us ideas of their own, as well as they respond to some of the things that we've tried. And we've already modified, and we're only just finishing year one of the project. It's a 3-year project. We've already made significant modifications based directly on feedback we got during those advisory panel sessions. Now, in addition to the panel, we also have on-farm trials. So we have several growers, several organic growers in each state that commit to doing trials with us. They have a significant voice in what the nature of the trial is, but it probably is going to have something to do with mesotunnels at this stage, and probably working with crops of interest to them and us. And our project personnel help them set up and keep track of the trials, and they report their observations and their thoughts and their data to us. So we have organic growers who are advisory panel members, and we have organic growers who are cooperators. So all in all, we have a fair amount. And then in addition to getting that sort of organized feedback, you might say, we are doing a lot of outreach to organic growers, and that takes a lot of forms. Even though we're limited in 2020 with face-to-face work, like face-to-face outreach like field days, we have compiled a nice series of blogs, and we've begun a video series and now a podcast series. And really all these are just devices to try to reach people who may be interested in these new systems and how they might potentially fit into the farming systems on their own farms.
Mark, now that you mentioned these devices, where can growers and general people learn more about the project?
Well, a good place to start would be the website, the project website, which is called the Current, C-U-R-R-E-N-T, Cucurbit. C-U-C-U-R-B-I-T, the Current Cucurbit. That's easily found if you just type those words, Current Cucurbit, into your search engine. You'll come up with the site and a number of the things we've already mentioned, plus a number of photos and other features are there explaining more in detail about the project. So that, I think that's a good place to start. We welcome people contacting us by email. My email is mgleason@iastate.edu, mgleason@iastate.edu. Welcome any feedback or thoughts that you may have about anything you see on the website. And then we're hoping to reach a wider range of growers through winter conferences. We have a number planned for this winter, although they're virtual, of course. We'll continue that over the next couple of years. And we'll do a grower survey at the end to see how this project has impacted thinking of growers or their consideration of organic options for managing these serious problems.
Okay, so that is pollination, but what about weed control? How can we control weeds inside the mesotunnels?
And this is a challenge that you have to face. If you've got a tunnel that you're essentially leaving in place, undisturbed mostly, for most of the growing season, how am I going to control the weeds that grow in those soil strips in between the plastic strips on which you grew the transplants? This is a significant portion of the planting. And under organic systems, weed control is always going to be a challenge. What you don't want is the weeds to explode in those soil strips such that they are stealing nutrients or shading the crop and therefore costing you yield. So we are looking at a number of strategies here. We've kind of settled right now on the idea of using a living mulch, and we've tried different things. We've tried clover rye mixes, and we were a little disappointed in the ability of those mixes to emerge fast and do an adequate job of weed control where weed pressure is high. What we're working with right now is an ancient cereal grass from East Africa called teff. That's T-E-F-F. And teff is remarkable in many ways. One is that it establishes quickly. It has a deep root system, so it's drought tolerant. And it establishes quickly enough in our experience that it can overtop the weeds fairly readily. But interestingly, in Iowa last year, we observed in a very dry year, extremely dry growing season, that the teff was maybe a little too successful in the sense that it filled those alleys, it filled those soil alleys between the plastic coated rows, but it grew tall enough and the roots were large enough that we could see that it was suppressing yield. So we have a good weapon in teff, but we're going to need to figure out how to aim that weapon more cleverly. What we're thinking right now is that we may be able to go in and mow the teff about 3 weeks after transplant. So you seed about the same time that you transplant, cover over with the mesotones, then you uncover for the, let's say, the 2 week period. And then you take a rotary mower in there and mow the alleys. And that may suppress the growth. We don't expect teff to come back as strongly after that mowing. That may suppress the weeds adequately in the early season, which is critical for weed control, and yet hold back the teff enough that it's really not a crop competitor. So we're looking hard at this teff. We're also looking at landscape fabric, but that's more of as a control. It's very effective, but it's also very expensive. So we're looking at a variety of different options. We were previously looking at crop debris like miscanthus or chopped corn stalks in between the rows, but we decided that that was not practical for many growers because many organic growers lack access to those products or they're simply out of range economically. So the living mulch has a lot of benefits, soil, increasing soil quality, increasing soil organic matter. So a lot of long range benefits that fit very well into organic vegetable management.
Okay, Mark, and where did this idea come from?
Yeah, good question, Jose. This project was born out of kind of trying to face the challenge or help organic growers deal with the challenge of managing these really hard to manage diseases. We have been working in this area for probably between Kentucky and us. We've been working in this area of organic cucurbit management for more than 10 years. And we started working with various kinds of strategies like low tunnels, and we evolved to mesotunnels. I think we're looking, this search is really about finding a viable strategy where there are currently no alternatives that guarantee or that give a grower confidence that he or she can consistently produce an adequate amount of marketable yield. If you don't have insect and disease problems in a certain year, anybody can grow a good crop. But what about those years with the bad insect and disease pressure? Those are the years we want to provide organic growers with a way to make a more consistent marketable yield. And so we've leaned heavily on this idea of a barrier strategy, but we've continued as we've gotten our results in and talked among each other and talked to growers, we've continued to evolve that strategy. And this particular project is kind of the culmination of 10 years of trying different strategy and some steps forward, some steps back. But we feel like this system has significant promise.
Well, thanks a lot, Mark, for sharing with us all these good information about the project. Any last comment?
I would just say, Jose, that if growers want to get a little more depth on this project, just get some more angles on it, they should go to the Qcurbit, the current Qcurbit website. That's current Qcurbit. Just type those names into your search engine and this website will come up. And in addition to the podcast episodes, and this is episode one, you'll find the blogs and other background information and progress reports. So yeah, I'd recommend that they go to the website. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Current Qcurbit podcast series. You can find more episodes in the series at the Current Qcurbit website. The link is www.qcurbit.iastate.edu. That's www.qcurbit.plantpath.iastate.edu. The host for this series is Mark Gleason. Jose Gonzalez is the editor. The Current Qcurbit podcast series is funded by a grant from USDA's Organic Research and Extension Initiative. For more information about the three-state project, contact Mark Gleason at mgleason@iastate.edu or Sarah Pethybridge at sjp277@cornell.edu in New York, or David Gonthier, djgo227@g.uky.edu in Kentucky.